Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The World Health Organization, WHO, has reiterated its concern about countries going it alone to secure sufficient COVID-19 vaccines for their populations at the expense of poorer nations. At a press briefing in Geneva, the UN agency also called for much quicker international cooperation to ensure that a large amount of doses could be rolled out to the countries that do not have the resources to purchase them themselves or to vaccinate. That work needs to be accelerated now, WHO spokesperson Dr. Margaret Harris told journalists. She also urged drug manufacturers to supply WHO with complete information on their products so that they can be checked thoroughly before distribution.
We want the manufacturers to submit their full data, their full dossiers, so we as WHO can do the full examination of that in order to issue an emergency use listing, because we can't put out the vaccines, you know, they can't be procured for vaccines, you know, they can't be procured for those countries until they've got that emergency use listing. So
the development comes 24 hours after WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus cautioned that while vaccines had brought hope to some, they had become another brick in the wall of inequality between the world's haves and have-nots. Although 39 million doses of vaccine have been administered in nearly 50 richer countries, only 25 have been given in one lowest income nation, Tedros said. To Haiti, where the UN Rights Office, OHCHR, warned on Tuesday against violent police repression amid growing calls for mass protests stemming from inequality and a fundamental lack of opportunities. Published on Tuesday, a new report from the UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, also detailed an environment of kidnappings for ransom, attacks by criminal gangs, and near-complete impunity for those responsible. Spokesperson Marta Hurtado expressed concern over what she called persistent insecurity, poverty, and structural inequalities in Haiti. These danger signs, coupled with increasing political tensions, may lead to a pattern of public discontent followed by violent police repression and other human rights violations that were seen during months-long protests in 2018, 2019, and in October and November last year, Ms. Hurtado told journalists. Among its recommendations, the UN Rights Office said that law enforcement officers should abide by international norms and standards during protests. The authorities should also ensure that gangs do not interfere with people's right to demonstrate peacefully, OHCHR added. Two United Nations peacekeepers from Gabon and Morocco have been killed after their convoy was ambushed and attacked in Southern Central African Republic, CAR. In a statement condemning the violence, the UN peacekeeping mission there, MINUSCA, blamed two armed groups that had acted together, UPC and Anti-Balaka. The assault, which comes after nationwide elections on the 27th of December, happened near Bangassou, the capital of Mbomou Prefecture. UN peacekeepers had retaken control of the city last Friday after its capture 2 weeks earlier by anti-government forces, who are reportedly calling for the resignation of the president. Mankur Ndiaye, head of MINUSCA, denounced the killings as war crimes, and he stressed that the mission would work with the Central African authorities to ensure that the perpetrators were held accountable. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with one of the nation's leading experts in re-entry after release from prison.
Joanne Page, she's the head of the Fortune Society. We should have a Fortune Society in every city in the country.
We used to call them incorrigible. Those are the girls and young women who have in the past been incarcerated in New York State.
These are rebellious girls. What do they really need? Listen in to Allison Cornyn talk about this.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Each year in the United States, more than 600,000 individuals are released from state and federal prisons. A staggering 6.9 million are on probation, in jail, in prison, or on parole. And on top of that, an additional 9 million people cycle through local jails. As grim as these statistics are, more sobering is the fact that more than two-thirds of prisoners are rearrested within 3 years of their release. Half of those are reincarcerated. Why is this recidivism rate so high? It has much to do with the failure of re-entry support programs. The U.S. has the world's largest carceral state, but no effective support system for persons finishing their sentences and re-entering society. Consequently, crime rates soar, more individuals are victims of crime, families and communities suffer when we fail to deal with the consequences of over-incarceration. When re-entry fails, the costs are high. More crime, more victims, and more pressure on an already strained budget system, both state and municipal. There is also more family distress and community instability. Community reintegration impacts several larger areas, such as community health, education, employment, family relationships, and housing. In every aspect, failure to support recently released individuals is costly to society. Joining us today is one of the nation's preeminent leaders in reintegration. Joanne Page is the president and CEO of the New York-based Fortune Society. Policymakers and researchers frequently cite the organization for its pioneering work. A graduate of Yale Law School, Joanne Page cultivated and created many of Fortune's signature programs, including substance abuse treatment, counseling, family services, HIV/AIDS health services, mental health programs, parenting initiatives, jobs training, and more. Joanne Page is a leading authority on issues including prison reform, solitary confinement, wrongful convictions, the over-incarceration of young men of color, violence prevention legislation, and many more. Joanne Page, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It is such a pleasure to be on your show. Thank you so much.
Joanne, when someone in New York State walks out of prison, often after many years, if they don't have family or friends or even a place to stay, what are they given in terms of money, assistance?
I'm glad you're asking that question, because the worst thing they're given, they are put in a shelter if they're homeless. So half the people coming out of New York State prison are put into New York City shelters if they're being released to New York City. And that is an awful way to start, especially for people who are older and really institutionalized and will have a tough transition, even under the best of circumstances. To land in one of New York City's large barrack-style shelters, which are often rife with violence and drug use, is just, it's like running a gauntlet.
You volunteered at the Fortune Society for years before becoming its executive director. Before that, you attended law school. You volunteered in prisons. How have prison reentry landscape changed from your early years till now?
You know, the prison reentry landscape has changed dramatically. I started doing volunteer work in the 1970s, just as the country was closing down its mental health capacity. And what I saw was people being transferred to prison who had been in the mental health system. And what we've seen since I started as a volunteer is a dramatic increase in the number of mentally ill people who are in prison. Right now, the jails and the prisons are the largest mental health, you can't call them treatment, but the largest mental health facilities in the country. And the other thing that I witnessed was the ballooning of the jail and prison population due to the so-called war on drugs. I worked at Legal Aid as a criminal defense lawyer starting in 1980, and I didn't even bother to memorize the codes for drug cases, because there were so few. And then with our so-called war on drugs, which was really a war on poor people of color with drug addiction issues, the prisons and the jails just ballooned. So that what we had was something like 22,000 people locked up in New York State at the height of incarceration in New York, which was 1991. And the positive thing we've seen is that we really have been bringing down the number of people who are locked up. So it was 22,000 people in New York City jails in 1991. The absolute lowest point was in April, right after the pandemic hit, when they started releasing people, and we had 3,800 people. So from 22,000 to 3,800, which was the lowest since the 1940s, partly due to bail reform, partly due to release through the pandemic. But what troubles me is we're starting to see an upward tick in people being locked up again, especially around pretrial detainees.
Before we get into the services that Fortune Society offers, I want to clarify, is it the Department of Correction, the State Division of Parole, and New York's Health and Human Services that ostensibly offer help for newly released persons?
I wouldn't say maybe any of those do. So the Department of Correction pretty much ends it once the person gets out. Then you have people who come out of state prison who can be placed on parole. They are supposed to be helping with people's reentry. There is no government entity that helps when people come out of the city jails. Essentially, what you have is a cobbled together group of nonprofits, Fortune among them, who barely scratch the surface of the needs. So when people come out of state prison, they're on parole by and large. But half of them who are being released to New York City, half of the parolees being released to New York City are dumped in the city shelters because they're homeless. With people who come out of jail, there's pretty much nothing except this network of nonprofit providers. And we are struggling beyond belief right now in terms of budget cuts, late contracts, uncertainty about funding. So there is no safety net. There really is no safety net. I think what there is a shredded, hole full net where most people fall through, and fall through hard and badly.
What kind of programs does the Fortune Society offer?
So we do a whole range. We call ourselves one-stop shopping because what we offer to anybody who walks in our doors is help in identifying their needs, crisis intervention, like food and clothing, and connecting them to the services that they need. And over the years, I've been at Fortune, believe it or not, 31 years, we've really expanded the range of services we offer. Our probably deepest intervention and our most limited resource is our housing, and we house about 400 people a year right now who were homeless and formerly incarcerated. But the need is so much greater. We see about 9,000 people a year, and 20-25% of them are homeless. So we see the transformation that housing offers, but unfortunately, we're able to offer it only to a small percentage of the people who need it. We also have other pivotal services. We do discharge planning from the jails. We work with people once they're in the community. We have licensed drug treatment and licensed mental health services. We have a whole employment array to help people get and hold jobs, get training, do stipended work when they're learning how to hold a job. So there are a whole array of services, but the need is so much greater. And, you know, more than half our staff are formerly incarcerated, which means that we are often where people come because somebody they know and trust has put their life together as a result of our services. The challenge is how to meet an enormous need with limited resources. We're also an advocacy organization because we don't just want to help people heal from the ordeal of incarceration or avoid alternatives. We also run alternative to incarceration programs. But what we want to do is try to change the policies that chew people up. So we're doing some work right now on the prison-to-shelter pipeline because we think it's appalling that half the people coming out of state prison are landing in the shelters. We've done major work and are doing major work around housing discrimination based on record and job discrimination based on record, because when people come home, they come home with an albatross around their necks. They get punished for the rest of their lives for that experience of being arrested and convicted and incarcerated. And in fact, the Brennan Center just did a recent study showing that people lose half their earning capacity if they've been incarcerated, that people who already were kind of on the bottom of the totem pole because of race and class in terms of earning have an earning capacity half that of similarly situated people who didn't go to prison. So those are core advocacy issues for us.
Tell us, please, about the Fortune Academy. It began as an abandoned drug den. What is it now?
Oh, it's a magical place. What we ended up doing was buying an abandoned building in West Harlem that had crack vials underfoot and that had major drug dealing in the backyard. And we turned it into a residence for people who are formerly incarcerated and homeless to let them land, build their skills for living in the current non-incarcerated world, and build a community of support, and then move out into the community. And we've been open since 2002. We probably serve about 100 people a year. And the joy for me is watching people transform, just watching people blossom when they're in a safe place. We did something I'm very proud of, and that is during the pandemic, we had to close intake at the Fortune Academy because we have so many people who are seniors and were medically vulnerable. But we opened a new building to house 38 people. And at the time that New York City and New York State were releasing medically vulnerable people, they wouldn't release those who didn't have an address. They wouldn't release those who were homeless. And we were able to create the beds to get 38 such people out of harm's way. So our housing is a pivotal part of what we do. And what you see in the Fortune Academy is what happens with people when they see hope and have a safe place to lay their head and have supportive services. We are seen as a model throughout the country. We replicated our housing in Syracuse, and we are talking to folks in Pennsylvania and Washington, D.C., and other places in the country about replicating that model. I would invite you to come visit, but because of COVID, we are doing our meetings in Zoom now.
Well, I'll take you up on your invitation, although I have to say I've been there and was extremely encouraged by what you folks are doing. Can you share a couple of stories about people who have done especially well from receiving your services?
Well, I'd like to share one story especially, and you mentioned David Rothenberg. He does his radio show on Saturday mornings on WBAI. And he interviewed one of our past residents, a woman named Becky, who got released from Rikers Island in her pajamas. And, I mean, with nothing, in her pajamas. And we were able to meet her, get her anchored at the castle, get her the clothing that she needed, help her build the confidence and the skills and the legitimate income source that let her move on. And she's currently living independently in the community. We have board members right now who came through the castle, came out of incarceration after decades of incarceration, and are now in the human services field making a difference to others, and on our board helping us continue our services. So the joy of this work is you can take people who are in crisis, who are coming out of really violent, dehumanizing experiences, and create an environment where people can put down roots and thrive and then reach back and help the other people coming behind them, which is a core part of our model, both for our staff and our clients, that the payback for the services, which we will not charge you for, is to reach back and help the next person coming down the pike.
Joanne, if you were running the nation's penal system, and we wish you were, what would you change?
The first thing I would do is shrink it dramatically. We lock up too many people. And no matter how humane a prison system is, locking people up does damage. So the first, and I think Jerry Miller in Massachusetts is my role model on that. What he did was he closed down the juvenile institutions, limited the number of beds, and look for alternatives for how to work with kids who are in trouble. So the first thing would be to bring the population down dramatically. We've got seniors who've served decades who are no risk to anybody. We've got people with nonviolent convictions. We've got people who turned their lives around. We've got people who, if they were not people of color, never would have been locked up in the first place. I mean, when we did three strikes in California, we locked up more people on marijuana than on murder, rape, and robbery combined. So first would be bring down the population so that you're keeping only people who would pose a risk to the community if they were not incarcerated. And then the second thing is we have no excuse for having the kind of vicious institutions that we have. People should be physically safe. They're not. People should be in an environment where they're treat somebody who you expect to see return to the community as a citizen, as somebody who matters. We should be treating people in a way that builds them, not that tears them down. So it would be two things. One is trim down the population dramatically, and the other is create institutions that are about healing and redemption. The punishment is being locked up. There is no reason that people should be under continual punishment once that punishment has been inflicted. And if you think of it in thirds, right, fewer people locked up, humane institutions for the very small minority who need to be locked up, and then removing the barriers to full participation in the community once people are released. I think what happened in Florida is both hope and a travesty. The hope is that people had had a lifetime ban against ability to vote if they were people with records. And the Florida voting population voted to lift that. And then the Florida legislature imposed the effect of a poll tax and kept those people from voting by saying that if they had any outstanding fines, they wouldn't be allowed to vote. So 3 points, right? Far fewer people locked up. Institutions that would do us proud as rehabilitative institutions, and removing the barriers to living a life in the community for people who have been released.
We're speaking with Joanne Page from the Fortune Society. Joanne, I want to ask you, why do we treat prisoners with so little regard for human life and dignity? And particularly, I wanted to ask you about the COVID pandemic. I've got a friend, David Gilbert, who's locked up in the Catskills of the Shawangunk Correctional Facility, and I speak with him on the phone frequently, and he tells me that they won't even let him go to the mess hall with a plate, get food, and come back to his cell. So he's got to sit next to people. The guards bring in the pandemic. Other prisoners who they sit cheek to jowl have it, and there's really no effort to protect these people, much less let them out. Why do you think that's true?
You know, I think what COVID did was just make vividly clear the inequities in our society, right? In terms of rates of death, in terms of who's at most risk, in terms of showing the problems in the medical system. And the criminal justice system is the belly of the beast. It's where our greatest inequities show up. So I was listening to the governor's State of the Union. He never mentioned prison populations as a population for vaccination. Right now, people in jails in New York City have almost 6 times the rate of COVID infection as New Yorkers in general. Right. What you're talking about in both the jails and the prisons is that people are confined right up against each other. They can't wash their hands. There are people who are not wearing masks. And heaven help you if you get sick. We've gotten letters from people who talk about being put in solitary confinement because they had COVID and getting very little medical care, sometimes not even getting adequate food. But basically being locked up and let's see what happens. Do you live or do you die? So what's happening right now about COVID is really obscene. It's really obscene. We and our colleagues are pushing hard to make sure that people who are locked up are a priority population to get vaccinated. But to put people in a situation where they have no recourse, where they can't escape, where they're at risk of infection, where if they get sick, they get terribly inadequate medical care, is an affront to civilized society. It's awful. It's really awful.
Do you see any hope for change with the incoming Biden administration?
You know, I'm so hopeful. One of the things that we see at Fortune is what we call system babies, and that's people who got raised by the system and did not have a loving family. And those children who were separated from their parents, who are scattered all over the country, who will never find their way back because there was no effort to be able to find them and reunite them again, that will not happen again. What we're also seeing is the private jails full of immigrants. Our hope is that that will change. We are seeing an escalation of the death penalty. We're seeing person after person executed after a hiatus of years. I don't think that will continue. President Obama was going to end contracting with private prisons. I hope that will happen. But also, what we need is work on racial equity issues, and the center of the target, in my mind, needs to be what happens in the criminal justice system. If you sit in court and you watch people flowing through that system, you rarely will see a white person. A racial skewing of our criminal justice system is so visible. My hope is that the promises that Biden has made, President Biden soon enough, President Biden has made, is that he is really going to address racial inequity. And I think the first place needs to be our criminal justice system, or rather, as people are saying now, our criminal legal system, because we need more justice in it.
Joanne Page, how can our listeners follow your work and learn more about the Fortune Society?
There are two ways to reach us. One is just through our website, which is fortunesociety.org. And the other is to call us. And that's 212. do it at 347-510-3601. And we want to be reached both by people who can help us in our work, either as volunteers or as donors or as people who can share coats, food. And we also want to be there for people who need our services, either for themselves or their loved ones.
You know, I'm a kid of Holocaust survivors, and to be able to do work that reflects my values with the kind of people who are the Fortune community both feeds my soul and makes me feel that I am making a difference in ways that really matter to me. So I feel incredibly lucky to have been able to do decades of this work.
Joanne Page, it's been beautiful talking with you. Thank you very much. Thank you for your good work, and we hope to have you on again in the future. Every success to you, Joanne.
Oh, thank you, and thank you for a wonderful interview. It's been a pleasure talking to both of you, and I'd invite you to come visit once it's possible to make that kind of invitation.
We'll be turning up at your doorstep.
Yeah, I love it. Thank you so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Currently living through multiple crises. The economy's in tatters with unemployment very high. The health situation is a disaster with over a third of a million people dead from COVID and tens of millions uninsured. The educational system has been ravaged underfunded, inflicted with charter schools. Billionaire right-wing Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos has only recently resigned. Almost half of the population is living in poverty. Families are in bad shape, with suicides, drug addiction, and divorces soaring. Many don't even have enough food, or homelessness is increasing. All of this is within the framework of a divided society deeply impacted by racism. How does this affect young people, and especially rebellious teenage girls? What laws apply to young people? How are they treated in a criminal justice system historically and currently cruel? What do we know about the level of abuse and neglect, including sexual abuse? We speak today with Allison Cornyn. She's a Brooklyn-based interdisciplinary artist, activist, and educator. She has long focused her career on social justice issues. A special interest of Allison Cornyn's has been the criminal justice system treatment of wayward teenage girls.
Allison, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Heidi.
Allison, you have a special interest in incorrigible girls and young women's incarceration, both past and present. You studied what happened to young women who were confined at the New York State Training School for Girls. Why do you care about this issue, and how did you get involved?
Thanks, Heidi. So I was researching archival documents from the New York State Training School for Girls through intake records, medical records, letters home, and piecing together stories of girls who had been sent to the institution in the 1920s for an exhibition that I was doing to be installed in an old mansion on the grounds of the institution, or the former institution, in the superintendent's house. And as I was developing the ideas for that, what struck me as I read through the documents was how many of the girls who had been sent to the institution had been physically and sexually abused. And I wanted to know why they were the ones that had been sent away and not the perpetrators of abuse. And it got me thinking to and wondering what's changed and not around youth justice and incarceration for girls today. So with that, I started down the road of a multi-year, multimedia documentary project called Incorrigibles.
Allison, where does the term incorrigible come from? What does it take to be labeled incorrigible?
So incorrigible was a term that I encountered in the archival documents again and again. So it was a popular offense for which a girl was sent to the training school. So the definition, according to Webster's, means unable to be reformed or corrected. So taken to an extreme, it basically means that the person that it's applied to is a lost cause, which led me to two thoughts. One is, given current studies into the brain and neuroplasticity, especially in young people, it's impossible not to be able to change. But second was really a question, more importantly, by whose standards and to what metrics were these girls being measured that enabled people in power, parents and courts and doctors, to determine that they weren't acceptable? And who was setting the rules for society's norms? It definitely wasn't the girls themselves. So besides incorrigible, they were charged with all other things similar, like having their morals corrupted, improper guardianship, being ungovernable and wayward. One girl was referred to as a soiled dove. So girls have been criminalized for incorrigible and defiant behaviors, like running away from home and fighting at home or staying out late. And often these actions are triggered by underlying problems, like including physical or sexual abuse, commercial sexual exploitation and survival sex, as well as neglect. So as the country continues to engage in a national dialogue around racism, sexism, and misogyny, and the convergence of all these realities in the lives of girls of color and LGBTQ gender nonconforming youth, we really have to review with new urgency why girls were and are being pushed into the justice system. So sometimes the past is a good place to start.
Allison, tell us more, please, about the New York State Training School for Girls.
So the New York State Training School for Girls was an institution that today we would call a youth prison. It was open from 1904 to 1975, and girls as young as 12 and as old as 18 from all over New York State were remanded there by the court. So over the 70-plus years it was open, there were as many as 15,000 girls who did time there. There were about 500 girls often there at a time, and they would stay for generally two or more years. In the 1920s and 30s, most of the girls came from poor immigrant families, Italian, German, Irish, and about 20% were African American. But by the time the institution closed, the majority of girls there were Black. And training at this quote-unquote school focused on educating the girls in kind of gender-segregated roles for the workforce. So they learned sewing and embroidery and cooking and housekeeping, as well as some furniture repair and bookmaking. The punishment could be harsh. They definitely used solitary confinement at the institution. It originally opened in 1887 as a New York House of Refuge, and it was set up in a cottage plan, which was kind of a house-like structure in a rural setting that was organized to provide a home-like atmosphere for incarcerated women. It was a system that came over from England. And currently, the facility is a medium-security men's prison called the Hudson Correctional Facility.
Allison, can you talk about how you found these people and what some of their stories are?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and it has many. There's all different ways that I've been piecing together the stories, because as I mentioned, thousands of girls were sent to this place, and their stories are still really being unearthed. So many of the archival stories of girls who are no longer alive came to light thanks to this really serendipitous occurrence. There was a box of documents that was bought for $5 at a yard sale by a thrift shop owner in Hudson, who shared it with me. And these are some of the documents I mentioned earlier from the 1920s and 30s. They were personal photos and letters, news clippings, medical records, intake forms, and parole paperwork. All of these documents had been spirited out of the institution, so they hadn't been destroyed. And so there were stories there. One that stands out was a young woman named Gladys. At 12 years old, she was sold by her mother and stepfather to be married to a boarder in their boarding house. And when this was found out, her mother and stepfather were sent to prison, and Gladys was then sent to an orphanage. But the orphanage staff was concerned that Gladys would, quote-unquote, corrupt the morals of the other children. So from there, she was sent to the training school. And photographs in the box led to research with the kind of corresponding documents. So there's a photograph of a young woman named Jewel Ward. Her name is written in pen above her head, and in the photograph she stands beside an unnamed, unknown Black girl, also at the institution. So Jewel was born in San Marcos, Texas, and she was sentenced to the training school in 1921 for being a disorderly child. And then in 1923, we see that she was discharged and sent to live with her mother in Manhattan. There's a young woman, Anna Murphy, who's also in a photograph, the daughter of Irish immigrants, who was born in New York City, and she was committed to the training school in 1925 at the age of 14 for being an ungovernable child. It's not clear when she left, but often girls would be paroled to jobs as maids or mother's helpers if home was not deemed to be a safe place to return to. So as part of the project, I put up a simple website to share some of the stories and the information about the training school, and people slowly started to write in. Many of them wanted to know about their mothers and sisters or aunts who had been incarcerated at this place. And family members often found, they sought out information because they would learn about relatives' time at the training school because their names were listed on census documents as inmates, and they would find them through Ancestry.com and other genealogical research sites. So in response to this, I worked with a wonderful young woman, Monsi, who interned with me one summer, and we kind of reverse-engineered Ancestry, and we created a tree, kind of a family tree of training school girls with over 2,000 names of girls in it who had been at the training school over 40 census years. And so in some cases, people who have relatives on Ancestry have reached out to share stories and or to get more information. So also through the website, other people wrote in, and they had been at the training school. They were still alive and wanted to tell their stories. And with them, I've been doing oral history interviews. So one woman named Liz, her grandmother died when she was 8, and the grandmother was kind of the stability of the family. And after that happened, Liz was separated from her 6 siblings and sent to an abusive foster home. And at 12, she was at the training school. another woman, Sharon, she's working on now as being a stand-up comic, and she's hilarious. When she was sent to the training school for shoplifting and running away. So her mom didn't want her to go to parties, so she would just leave. Lily is another woman who's been very involved in the project, and we're still trying to uncover, you know, her records to find out. She doesn't even know why she was sent there. One of the earliest women that I've spoken to, her name is Hilda. She was at the training school in the 1950s, and she ran away from home because her mother came after her one day with a knife, and she went to live with a local man. She became pregnant, and one day she came home with the baby, and about a week later she was sent by her mother to the court and sent to the training school.
Didn't Ella Fitzgerald spend some time at the New York training school?
Yes, Ella was definitely there, and it was quite a find. Nina Bernstein, who wrote for the New York Times, in researching her incredible book about the history of the foster care system in New York, it's called The Lost Children of Wilder, she found out about Ella being there in an interview with one of the house mothers who had worked at the school when Ella was there. So I was able to find Ella's entry in the institution's intake book in the New York State Archives. And so she was committed in April 1933. And written in the book, it says her offense was that she was ungovernable and will not obey the just and lawful commands of her mother, a judge delinquent, quote unquote. And at the time, however, her mother had passed away, and she was living with an aunt and an abusive uncle. And so it's likely that she was running away and acting out, and she was at the training school. And while she was there, Ella was forced to live in segregated housing. They were segregating the cottages in that period. And she wasn't allowed to sing in the choir because she was black. And she was invited back in the 1970s by the superintendent to visit the institution, but she wanted nothing to do with the place.
That makes sense. Well, this all leads up to the central question, Allison. What do rebellious girls really need?
Yeah, that's a very good question. We should ask my 16 and 14-year-old daughters that as well. The most important thing is to ask them, really. In the conversations that I've had with young women, it's what they need is to be seen and heard and to have some autonomy over their own lives. They need to be able to define for themselves who they are and to be free from sexist and racist labels. Also, rather than being punished and controlled, they need opportunities to take charge of their own lives, assistance for their families, good education, medical care, and safe places to be and grow. But really, I think the question we need to ask is why, when girls are acting out, why they're doing what they're doing. Because girls do run away, but often they're running away from physical abuse or sexual abuse or family chaos, which brings us back to family stress around poverty and housing and racial injustice. And so these root causes need to be addressed.
Allison, is the term incorrigible still used?
The term incorrigible is still used in New York. It's as a subcategory of PINS. PINS are, it's a person in need of supervision, and it's someone under the age of 18 who can be arrested and sentenced for a status offense. And your listeners probably know what that is, but a status offense are activities that if they were 18 or older wouldn't be considered crimes. Things like not going to school, truancy, running away, being habitually disobedient or beyond the control of a parent or guardian, or someone who's suspected of drug abuse, or being sexually active.
Talk about the bill in the New York State Legislature, which excises the word incorrigible.
So in 2019 and 20, the last legislative session, a bill was introduced. It was sponsored by Julia Salazar and promoted by GGE, a great organization called Girls for Gender Equity, among others, to amend the Family Court Act and to finally eliminate the use of the term incorrigible. They wanted to eliminate the stigma of being labeled as incorrigible in PINS proceedings, because implicitly and in practice, it singles out girls of color for not matching expectations of stereotypical feminine behavior and labels them as uncorrectable or unreformable. So it did pass in the Senate in the last session, but the Assembly sponsor wasn't able to move it forward. So the bill is going to be reintroduced and hopefully passed in New York this legislative session.
Allison, is sexual behavior denominated as a disorder?
Many courts do continue to see the sexual behavior of teenage girls as a disorder, especially in relation to LGBTQ and gender nonconforming identities. And families often are unaccepting of their own children's sexual behavior and gender.
The present status of juvenile justice and social services for girls and for youth, how should we address these issues?
Well, I think it starts with an understanding that no kids should be in prison, because often young people are acting out of when they're acting out or doing so in response to trauma or drama, and incarcerating them rather than addressing the cause of their problems only serves to further traumatize and hurt them. And punitive systems really aren't systems of justice. So there's a groundswell of organizations who have been working to end both girls' incarceration and youth incarceration. And their work is long and arduous, but it's beginning and it has been getting results. So I want to shout out kind of some of those institutions which have been really working for many years on these issues, which is the Vera Institute of Justice, and Girls for Gender Equity, National Crittenden, and Georgetown Law School's Initiative on Gender Justice and Opportunity. So Vera started in New York City working with the city to try and end girls' incarceration in the city completely within 5 years. They have almost been able to do that, and they've also expanded their work in with other cities. And for youth, there's a really amazing organization called Youth First. It's an initiative, really, rather than an organization. They work with local community partners with the goal of having no kids in prison across the U.S. So it's their initiative will be wrapping up in 2022. It's a 6-year limited time project, but they're working with communities affected by youth incarceration. And the goal is to end incarceration in 15 states. Then that can create a tipping point for other states when their initiative ends. So through their work in Connecticut, the Connecticut Juvenile Training School closed in 2018. What's an issue, though, is the funds that are used to run these places aren't necessarily invested back into the community or community-based programs. So, and very often, once a prison closes, there's this knee-jerk reaction to build another different kind of prison. So, that's really something that needs to be addressed. And very often, it needs to, you know, again and again and again, people have to go into communities where prisons are being proposed to be built and work with the community to fight it off. So, I know since your listeners are national, there's work happening in Maine, very recent legislation to close a place called the Long Creek Youth Development Center. In Ohio and Louisiana and Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania is going to be introducing recommendations to the legislature in March, as well as in New Mexico. And the method that they're using to think through the next steps and reinvestment planning is to do partnerships and with envisioning sessions with young people and community members so they can come up with recommendations for reinvestment and how money will be spent in their communities, and starting with closing prisons, create ways to divert arrests, come up with local initiatives for supporting young people so they don't even come into contact with the system. You know, these might be things like recreational and sports programs, job programs, not just alternative to incarceration, to kind of start earlier.
To give us a sense of the scope of this, how many young persons are incarcerated today, both in New York State and also across the nation?
So the federal government doesn't keep their numbers so up to date, unfortunately, for the national tabulation of how many young people are in prison. But according to the OJJTP, the Office of Juvenile Justice, and their numbers, the most recent are from 2017, there were 43,580 young people incarcerated. And since we're in COVID now, the Sentencing Project has been keeping tabs on how many youth are infected with COVID, which is And there's been a lot of work to try and get kids released, which has, like in the larger prison system, hasn't had much of an effect. But as of January 8th, there have been 3,360 youth infected with COVID while they've been incarcerated. So New York State, the Children and Family Services numbers, the OCFS, is from 2019, and there were 388 youth in youth prisons. So this is a 73% decrease since 2010. So there's a lot of work in New York, state and city, to really bring down and end youth incarceration. And one thing that to not be forgotten about really is the cost. The Justice Policy Institute did a whole research paper on the cost of secure confinement of a young person in the U.S., which is, on average is $588 per day or $214,000 a year. And in New York, it's $2,000 a day and about $750,000 a year. So some of that money really should makes sense just in terms of a financial, on a financial level to kind of reinvest that in communities and not in incarceration.
Now, Alison Cornyn, what proportion of these children are people of color, both nationally and in New York State?
Well, black youth are five times more likely than white youth to be under state supervision in prisons and detention and group homes. And this number hasn't changed since 1997. Monique Morris wrote a book called Push Out about how black girls are pushed out of schools. And she talks about school-to-confinement pathways rather than the school-to-prison pipeline to capture all the ways and the multiple places in which young people can be, especially girls, can end up in detention centers and house arrest and electronic monitoring, and especially black girls. One thing I wanted to mention, this is something that just came out, is so Girls for Gender Equity, they have a State of Black Girls report, and it's in response to Governor Cuomo's recent State of the State address that just came out. And the youth that they work with came up with specific things that they need and they're calling for, which is educational equity, ending criminalization, ending sexual abuse, and ending the use of sexist and racist labels like incorrigible. That's the bill.
Tell us what you're currently working on.
Thanks, Heidi. So I'm completing a book around incorrigibles. It's primarily a visual book, but I've started to write substantially about the issues. I'm still meeting with women and family members of women who are at the training school and doing oral history interviews with them. I've been structuring and adding elements to a traveling exhibition about the past and present of young women's incarceration. It's currently at the New York City Municipal Archives. It was supposed to be there for 2 months, but because of COVID, it's had a very long life. The same exhibit was at the Brooklyn Federal Courthouse Gallery. And whenever the exhibition travels, it's really kind of the means to hold public events and have conversations about the past and present of young women's incarceration. I'm also in the process of editing some short video interviews with experts in youth justice for girls, many of whom are young people and formerly incarcerated women. And my original plan was to create a website to map out and house stories from women all over the country who were confined in similar institutions, because every state had at least one of these facilities, and some have only recently closed. I begin to realize that that's going to be too large of a project for me. But so I'm working on developing a toolkit for people who want to kind of do this work themselves and house stories. So there can be an aggregation of this history. And then finally, I'm in dialogue with relevant partners in the field, some of whom I mentioned earlier, to continue to see how my work can support the work that they're doing. Oh, and there's one thing that I wanted to mention, which really grew out of incorrigibles, and it's something that I've become passionate about, is this Child Victims Act. There's a in New York, there's a Child Victims Act look back window, which enables a 1 year window which anyone who was sexually abused as a child can file a suit against their abuser or an institution that should have protected them. And one of the women that I was working with, Hilda, was sexually abused in the entire period of time that she was at the training school. And so we found a law firm, a wonderful law firm here in New York, Emery Celli, that's representing Hilda on a case against the state. And we're looking to find other women who may have been at the institution while Hilda was there, or who may have been sexually abused at the institution. And finally, just in general, I'm trying to get the word out more broadly about the Child Victims Act, because the window, this one-year window, which was extended by a year due to COVID, closes August 14th, 2021. And so after that, anyone who was sexually abused and who is over 51 won't be able to file a case.
Alison Cornyn, you're just doing wonderful, wonderful work. Thank you so much for being on this Law and Disorder. And we'd like to have you back when you finish the book. Can you please tell our listeners how they can reach out to you?
Oh, sure. Thanks, Michael. So there's a website up about the Incorrigibles Project. It's at incorrigibles.org. And there's a newsletter sign up on that site. We don't send out too many messages, about four times a year, updates on issues and what's happening with the project. I also have a design studio, Picture Projects, which is picture-projects.com, which links to the simple site that was put up around the Child Victims Act to get more information about that. And then Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for the project that people can follow as well.
Alison Cornyn, it's just been terrific having you on Law and Disorder. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Michael. And thank you so much, Heidi.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.